This episode is sponsored by Down to Earth Iced Teas. Our functional super teas are made from organic super herbs and adaptogens and contain no sugar, no preservatives, no food colorings, and range from only 0 to 10 calories per bottle. Our beverages are USDA organic, kosher, vegan, non-GMO, and keto and paleo friendly. Finally, bottled beverages that you can truly trust. Check out drinkdowntoearth.com and use promo code PODCAST10 for 10% off your first order. Welcome back to the Down to Earth podcast. Our guest today is Dr. Lilia Hartwell. Dr. Hartwell is a naturopathic physician and founder of Saguaro Blossom Medical Center in Phoenix, Arizona. Dr. Hartwell specializes in autoimmune and chronic infectious diseases and uses her clinical knowledge and empathy to support patients during their healing journey. In this episode, we will be discussing different autoimmune conditions, including autoimmune thyroid disease, rheumatoid arthritis, and psoriatic arthritis, just to name a few. We will also be discussing potential risk factors and causes of autoimmune conditions, as well as the role that diet and lifestyle modification can contribute. Here we go.
Welcome to the Down to Earth podcast.
We're your hosts, sibling duo, Jonathan and Lorena.
In this podcast, we'll be spilling the tea on all things health and wellness related.
This podcast is designed to motivate you to take care of your physical, mental, and spiritual health.
We'll be bringing on doctors, healers, fitness experts, business leaders, and innovators.
Thanks for joining us in our mission of making the world a healthier, happier, and a more down-to-earth place. Here we go.
Hi, Dr. Hartwell. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It is absolutely my pleasure.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, I'd love to start off by talking a little bit about what ultimately inspired you to pursue a career in medicine.
That's such a difficult question. So I didn't have the linear route that a lot of my cohort seemed to have. I didn't grow up knowing I wanted to be a doctor. So it's kind of a culmination of a few things. I think chief among them would have to be my experience as a young child. So I'm Mexicana, and my nana loved for me to swim in the pool. And unfortunately, basically the pool was not as clean as it should have been. I developed a really severe infection as a child from that experience. It actually led to such hypertrophied lymph nodes around my head and neck that they were the size of golf balls. And the conventional medical system didn't really know what to do with me. And that was for over a year. Like, can you imagine lymph nodes and the size of golf balls and your around your ears and your neck? And it's just, oh, so the doctors were saying that they needed to do a surgical removal. That really didn't identify with my family because it's like you're removing a portion of your lymph system. And that's kind of a critical portion around your brain and everything of that nature. So my father actually sought special permission to take me to a Native American shaman, and he ended up using a botanical medicine to bring down the swelling. So that was like my first skirmish with medicine and healing and the healing power of the body, the human body. And then sometime later in the seventh grade, I was diagnosed with my first autoimmune condition. And my doctor told me there's no cure, there's no effective treatment. And I saw answers for myself. And again, I ended up rectifying the condition. And then by the time I was a junior in college, I was diagnosed with another autoimmune condition. And we'll talk a little bit later probably about comorbidity and the co-involvement and development of multiple autoimmune syndrome. And then that autoimmune condition was involved with a debilitating infection. So I do a lot of world travel, and I don't really necessarily do the I'm going on a tourist adventure. I kind of do the I'm doing a medical mission in the middle of nowhere, and I'm going to learn about indigenous cultures. And when I came back, from one of my adventures, I had a particularly debilitating chronic infectious disease that went undiagnosed despite multiple visits to urgent care and excessive weight loss and all of these things. And each time I was really confronted with folks who didn't have the answer. So I kept seeking them for myself. I'm not one of those door shut in the face, okay, then let's not walk through the door kind of people. So I found the other doors. And I wound up following kind of a path that my grandmother and my great-grandmother used in Mexican traditional medicine, for plant medicine being the healing modality. And if you fast forward to my discovery of naturopathic medicine, I discovered, hey, this is actually what I have been wanting, what I've been searching for. And I thought first it was herbalism alone. And then I realized naturopathic medicine existed. I went on some adventures with Naturopaths Without Borders, assisting them in their clinic before I graduated from undergrad. And I discovered that naturopathic medicine had a huge scope in Arizona. And now I'm a fully licensed naturopathic doctor that supports people in the exact autoimmune conditions that I was told there were no answers for. So that's kind of how I got there.
That's amazing. And again, I give you a lot of credit for taking, you know, the authority to really look for alternative medicine and treatments for what you were going through. Because I feel like a lot of people probably just go see one doctor, they get a plan from them, and they just follow that, even if that's not the best plan to support them. So I give you a lot of credit for knocking down different doors and figuring out ultimately what worked best for you.
Thanks. Actually, it's something that I've really come to formulate so much of my practice around. Like, I had this discussion with someone yesterday. Their previous provider had told them they weren't a compliant patient. And I said, they use the word compliant. And, you know, I've sort of developed kind of a wariness about the use of the word compliant, just because it's so easy to write someone off and say, hey, you're not being compliant with my treatment plan. Maybe I'm not the provider for you. I like to say, hey, maybe this treatment plan isn't serving you. How can we choose something that will serve you and suit your best interest? And what is it that's not working with this treatment plan? How can I revise and meet you where you're at, kind of thing? And I feel like that wasn't something I was getting from my providers over and over and over again, even when I would like desperately research these people and say, look at all their training. And then I'd get there in front of them and they're like, tell me everything in 3 minutes or less. And I was like, wow, I kind of need a little bit more time than that.
And that's what's really great with naturopathic medicine too, is we have so many tools. So, you know, if something is not working for a patient, we have so many other tools and therapies that can help support the patient.
Exactly. It's those modalities and their scope and their breadth and what's indicated for whom and when. I change everything each time someone comes to see me if it's not working. And we have the beauty of doing that rather than, oh, this pharmaceutical didn't work, let's try this other one.
Now, as you mentioned, you see a lot of autoimmune conditions in your practice. And so I want to start off with those who are unfamiliar with what autoimmune disease is. I'd love for you to speak a little bit about more on what it is and common autoimmune conditions that you see most in your practice.
Autoimmunity to me is this invisible illness. You may sit next to someone on the bus or your Uber driver, you know, whatever the situation is. And you don't even know that that person, you see them in the grocery store, they look like they're in the peak of health. You don't even know that person could be fighting an invisible illness like autoimmune disease, and you have no idea. So to me, autoimmune disease describes conditions really where the immune system is overactive and it's targeting the body itself. And that's just normal cells are no longer recognizing their own cells. This can lead them to an attack formation, which could lead to disease and dysfunction, or it could resolve as a transient component of someone processing emotions, which I have had in the past as well with patients. So the presentation of autoimmune disease, it varies, and it's so fascinating. I'm one of those people, I love my patients as much as if they were my family, but I also love and respect these conditions and these diseases and the fact that this is a manifestation of something, and honor it and then go from there. So the number one autoimmune condition that I see in my practice is psoriasis. Probably comes as no surprise, but as you know, I love psoriasis. I think it's a really fascinating disease, and it has so many comorbidities that are undervalued and not really discussed. So that's what my most recent case study publication was about. I treat a lot of other components of spondyloarthropathy as well, including ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. I'm also on the Hashimoto's thyroiditis spectrum, Sjogren's, scleroderma, rheumatoid arthritis, Raynaud's, gout, and then there's my most special interest of all, which is lupus. And so those are the most common autoimmune conditions that I treat. But being a general practitioner, I also see a heck of a lot of that as well. My RA patient may have, you know, a cold or whatever, what have you, or something that they need removed. And I do that as well.
I love that you mentioned that you love these diseases and you're so fascinated by them, because I find that a lot of people will go into see their doctor, they get a diagnosis, and they kind of carry that and allow that to define them and have this almost like a fear. And it seems like you're embracing them and looking at the manifestation and helping treat the whole person, as well as obviously the autoimmune condition that persists.
Yes, that is such a unique discussion for us. I talk to these to some of my patients, they'll be the patients that have on the license plate, you know, their disease, if they can fit it into 7 letters or less. And I have the earnest discussion of, are you your disease? And separating that out is usually the first thing I like to do, if not in the handful of first things, is parsing that you are who you are, and what you've manifested or what you've been diagnosed with and are carrying is a whole other thing. And I don't really like for it to define who the individual is, because sometimes people have a harder time separating themselves from it and healing from it. But that's just something I've noticed in my clinical practice.
Now, we've mentioned an array of autoimmune conditions. And so there are obviously many possible etiologies of these autoimmune conditions. So what are some of the main contributing factors that you've seen in the research or in your patients?
Oh my goodness, the possible etiologies of autoimmune conditions just can go on and on. The most notable one, though, the most common probably in my experience, is a genetic polymorphism that alters their reaction to medication. It could be sunlight, or there's an increased risk for nutrient deficiency or some kind of underlying metabolic dysfunction. And then, of course, the environment plays a huge role. You could have underlying heavy metal toxicity from work or a toxic burden from chemical exposure. And that could be as simple as cleaning your toilet or cleaning your kitchen. Or for a lot of women, I often find their hair and beauty regimen to have components of chemicals that disrupt the metabolic syndrome and really aren't serving them. And that includes a lot of exposure as well. And then there's gut dysbiosis. And frequently when I'm talking about gut dysbiosis, I'm also talking about underlying chronic infections that are hiding in the bowel. And that's something I see quite frequently as the cause of inflammation and dysregulation in the immune system, which plays a huge role in the manifestation of autoimmune conditions. And then there's also that sneaky little thing that nobody ever really likes to talk about, which is the diet. So if there's one thing that my undergraduate degree in plant sciences really revealed to me, was that the soil is no longer what it once was. Soil mismanagement, it's rampant. And there's nutrient deficiencies in our food production system. And the nutrients that are contained, they may not be what we expect. So I frequently talk to patients about their source of their food, what they're doing with their food once they get their food, like the processing and the cleaning, and how frequently are they cleaning out their fridge? What choices are they making? You can go to a health food store and still buy all of the processed food that you're trying to avoid because it's found everywhere. So if you're working on a whole food diet or what have you, there are still ways to make that unhealthy. And it's so that's a huge component of the etiology of a lot of autoimmune conditions I see. If you have a gut dysbiosis and an underlying chronic infection, throw in a little processed refined sugar, all of a sudden, what was once serving you is no longer serving your body, and it can manifest in kind of brutal ways sometimes. So,
yeah, and we always talk about that at home, how we live in a society now where it seems like there's so much more access to information or healthier, better for you products. But you could think that you're living a healthy lifestyle nowadays and trying to do everything right, but still not really living a truly healthy lifestyle because of the things that are in our air quality, like you mentioned, in our soil, the additives that are now added to food. So there really are a lot of factors that are hard to avoid that are already setting you up for failure, which makes it even more important to really control the things that you can.
Oh, certainly. And that's often, you know, very frequently people don't feel comfortable taking a multivitamin. And that's something that I have to bring up is, based on my research, our environment is no longer what it once was. And so we might need to support our body in ways that weren't previously done. And it's funny that you bring that up as well. I just had a patient a couple of days ago. You would think she is the peak of health, and she has post-Lyme syndrome, a lot of neurological component to what she's currently suffering from, and as well as arthritis. And it's a whole bear of a thing. But you would think she's one of the healthiest people that you've ever come across. And then I get her lab results back and she's deficient in all of these different things, like almost to the point of malnourishment. Wow. And it was just very interesting to me, you know, the presentation of the person and then the labs that I'm looking at correlating the two. It was just very surprising. I was just surprised. So we had to counsel about that, which was super unexpected. But that just harps on going back to the basics, and someone can think they are living the healthiest lifestyle until you really parcel out what is or isn't working for them and their body. You don't really know. And then you get the labs and you're like, wow, okay, maybe we have some more work to do that we already thought we tackled.
Yeah, so many people might look like the pillar of health. They might look fit. They might look muscular, and all these ideologies that sort of shown to us as symbolizing health, but you don't really know what's going on inside. Unless you're running the labs, unless you're getting the tests, it's so hard to know what health really looks like because it comes in so many different shapes and sizes and forms.
I'm in complete agreement. And I wish more people had a better understanding of that. They could do all the quote unquote right things, but if what's going on inside is not matching what they're doing on the outside, that can manifest in different ways as well.
Definitely. Now, I'd love to speak with you a little bit about comorbidities with some of the autoimmune conditions that you have, you know, patients that have presented you with.
It depends really on which autoimmune condition you have, but typically if you develop one autoimmune condition, you're likely to develop another. So the ironic component of this is that a comorbidity of one autoimmune condition could be the development of another. And we see this most frequently with autoimmune thyroiditis. So a lot of times I'll have a patient, and it's funny because a colleague of mine just brought up this same theme that they've been seeing in their practice, which is the patient arrives, hasn't really been worked up. I'd love to talk to you about the thyroid in a sec, but they haven't really been worked up. We come to find out, hey, they maybe have Hashimoto's, and then sometime later, they manifest additional symptoms, or those symptoms were already ongoing and their Hashimoto's was undiagnosed for a few years and they've already manifested a whole other. So oftentimes when someone's coming in to me for something thyroid related, or when I'm taking the case, it's a myriad of symptoms that I'm piecing together. All of a sudden that seemed to strike me as thyroid. Then I go down my list, my review system questions that accompany if they have arthritic pain, joint pain, swelling, unexplained fatigue and weakness, or stiffness, joint stiffness, and just got to cover those bases to see if they're already on that path or if we can curb that path. So that's very interesting. Other comorbidities, particularly with psoriasis, which I think kind of don't get discussed enough, can be dyslipidemia issues, processing fats, liver dysfunction, as well as a lot of cardiac involvement, which you really wouldn't expect, but that has a lot to do with the dyslipidemia and possible underlying metabolic dysfunctions.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And that's why it's so important to look at the person as a whole and not just the psoriasis or the skin condition, for example, but making sure you're running those labs and being aware of the research and other comorbidities that exist.
Definitely. It kind of astounds me. Someone will come in with a lesion, they'll just get seen by their dermatologist. I actually have had patients with psoriasis just go undiagnosed for years and years because the dermatologist didn't necessarily recognize how systemic it had reached. Because, you know, there is psoriasis, but then there's psoriatic arthritis, and that could develop in a large percentage of that patient population as well. But when going to see their dermatologist, that was never discussed. So by the time they see me, they're 20 years deep in some kind of spondyloarthropathy that destruction of bone could have been avoided decades before. But that's a whole other story.
Yeah, and that's why it's so important to really always kind of check in with your body. I feel like when you're super busy and you have so many things going on, you're not really asking yourself how you feel. And a lot of times you might ignore an ache or a pain and just say, oh, it's probably inflammation, or I might just be sore. But our body does oftentimes communicate with us when something is wrong. So it is important to always sort of feel where you're at.
Yeah. So let's just dive into stress management since you brought that up, Jonathan. So stress management, I would have gotten this class in elementary school because I come from a family that's very much rise from the bottom. Work hard, hustle, do your best in everything, and education is the key. So starting out, you know, being a family that didn't have a lot of money, that is the path. If you want to rise above that, is you do really well in school or athleticism. I'm clearly an athlete in other avenues, not organized sports. But I am very much a rock climber, kayaker, backpacker. But none of that's really, there's no dogma for that necessarily being competitive. Although the Olympics, the sailing Olympics have just been incredible. I'm so grateful that I've been able to watch that. But oh my goodness, what a tangent. Okay, stress management. So I wish that that was being taught in elementary school because I didn't get that. I missed the course in stress management. And I think that's why in the seventh grade, I clearly had a previous lowered immune system that was overactive based on these infections that I was dealing with at such a young age. And then an altered, I now have fibrotic lymph nodes from that infectious disease that we still don't know what it was. But I did not know how to manage my stress. And so a body that's already not really the healthiest and then not knowing how to handle stress, and then I'm manifesting all these autoimmune conditions. I like to think of it as if you're in chaos as a being, that translates onto the cellular level. And I like to tell my patients, take it from a goal-oriented, hyper-functioning human. I'm the most productive when I take the time consistently to rest and recharge. And I do this on a daily basis. And I do want to caveat that that does not have to mean that you sit and meditate in silence for an hour. I do have patients that that works for. That's the space that they're called to compose themselves in. But I really harp on what that means to me and what that means to others can be dealing with a past trauma, processing it. For example, something that comes to mind is I worked with a Sjogren's patient and her disease onset began after the passing of her mother-in-law. So she was on the phone with her mother-in-law as her mother-in-law passed away in a tragic accident. And it was an extremely traumatic experience. The patient didn't really process it. And then it was kind of fascinating. Shortly after that, she developed symptoms of Sjogren's. So her symptoms were resolved with a well-chosen homeopathic remedy and some other emotional processing techniques. But we didn't really tell her, you know, go sit in silence for an hour each day and meditate. Like, she processed her stress and trauma in a completely different way. And that worked for her, that served her, and that helped in her overcoming her autoimmune condition. And she no longer has any Sjogren's symptoms at all. And her titers are negative, so she doesn't have any antibody titers anymore. But anyway, moving meditation is another common practice that I suggest to my patients, the specifics of which I won't get into here, but suffice it to say that stress management is much like hair. It's different and it's unique to each individual based on their life and their lifetime.
It's really interesting that you mentioned that because I think our society really applauds success and is very goal-driven and oriented, but we fail to look at the journey that took us to get there. And I think if there's one silver lining of COVID and the pandemic is it forced a lot of people to slow down and kind of realize like, oh, wow, I was really stressed. I've been really exhausted. Now, on the other hand, I think that stress could have possibly increased a lot for people too. And there's a lot of trauma associated with that. So it'll be interesting, you know, if we see a rise in numbers of autoimmune or any other chronic conditions as a result.
Yeah, this is a time for the history books, I must say. Absolutely. But yeah, the slowing down, huge, huge. And then checking in and saying, hey, wow, why am I rushing about this? Like, I could cushion the time a little bit more and then there won't have to be a rush. And it's a little bit more forethought. It's a little bit more foresight and planning. And for some people, that makes all the difference. Especially in this kind of city, Phoenix is just, you don't want to get stuck in a 45-minute traffic jam here and then be late to something else. It's just unnecessary stress.
Absolutely. Now, I do want to ask you also, why do you think it is that women are more susceptible to most autoimmune conditions? I know there are some like ankylosing spondylosis, which is more common in males, but for the most part, it seems like females are more susceptible.
That is just an action-packed question, Lorena. So there are many theories why women are more susceptible to autoimmune conditions. A recent one that has been developing over the past few years, it regards a protein called the overexpression of VGLL3, which is the vesicular-like family member 3. It's in skin cells, and kind of how the theory goes is that there's change expression levels in a number of genes that are important to the immune system. this kind of came out of the University of Michigan. There was a mice study and then some further development. And they've been concluding that the overexpression of this gene protein may wreak havoc on the immune system. And there are a number of other considerations, including like susceptibility to cancer and infection or increased sensitivity to side effects of medications, or could be due to endocrine disruptors and pollutants in daily lifestyle products from unregulated institutions like the cosmetic industry. But quite frequently, you know, these polymorphisms are what come to mind when we're talking about women. And then that general exposure, how many, probably not in the naturopathic colleague community, but how many women do you know that are using products on their face and in their regimen and in their shower or their bath that they don't know anything about? Ingredients that they can't read on the back, that they don't know what they mean, or we now know are code for something that could be toxic to the body. So I think that plays a huge role in female susceptibility to autoimmune conditions.
Definitely. And I'm really glad that you mentioned that, because a lot of people forget that what you put on topically gets absorbed by your skin, hair follicles, so many different parts of your body that we usually don't even think about, but it does eventually get internalized and could lead to potentially negative, detrimental health effects.
Definitely. The skin is the largest organ and it's often the most overlooked, which is super surprising. I just had a patient come to me just diagnosed with 6 squamous cell carcinomas on the skin, 38-year-old male, super healthy looking. You would have no idea. And he just had a few moles that he let go unchecked. Come to find out he's been tanning a lot, no sunscreen. I was like, are you using sunscreen? The quizzical face just popped up on his face. And I was like, okay, so that's where we got to start somewhere here. But unfortunately, it often gets overlooked. And the idea that we're absorbing things that are topically, it's so frequently overlooked. It's alarming.
Yeah, people should definitely start to pay some more attention to what they're putting on topically as well as what they're internalizing. Now, I'd love to speak with you a little bit about thyroid diseases. It seems that thyroid diseases are extremely common, especially Hashimoto's and Graves' disease. So I'd love to learn a little bit more about your experience with those diseases.
Well, you guys know I'm a licensed naturopathic doctor and I'm practicing in the largest state scope as of this recording. I carry a DEA, so that means that I can prescribe pharmaceuticals if I deem them necessary. In hypothyroidism, I tend to support the thyroid through hydrotherapy, nutrient replenishment, and diet as best as I can before we consider thyroid medication. But they're really, if the patient's trying to avoid taking thyroid medication and they're already currently dosed on it, I may adjust the dose or change the source or alter the ratio of T3 to T4 based on their blood work and their clinical symptoms. And then, of course, there's Graves, which in Graves' disease, we need to determine the underlying cause. That form of hyperthyroidism, we're going to need to make diet and lifestyle changes. And quite frequently, I use botanicals to make alterations in how the thyroid is processing the hormones. But there's quite a lot of tests that can be run that typically aren't run. So when someone comes to me and they have chronic fatigue or unrelated, unintentional weight gain that seemed abrupt to them, and there was no particular change in their habit, some of the things that first run through my mind are, do we need to assess their thyroid? Do we need to assess them for infection? And then we need to assess for anemia, especially in my female patients. And testing is probably the most significant issue that my patients struggle with. They come to see me with that chief complaint, that CC of abrupt unintentional weight gain or extreme unexplained fatigue. And then they tell me their primary provider already told them their thyroid is within normal limits. Okay, so over here, I'm like, what does that mean? Like, how did they assess that your thyroid was within normal limits? I get permission to request medical records. And then when I review them, typically all that's been ordered by the primary provider is a TSH. And that's the thyroid stimulating hormone. Or maybe they've ordered total T4 or total T3. And we don't really order that, you know, that's kind of like 30-year-old information to order the total T4 and T3, which are the end of a trophic cascade of thyroid hormones. So thyroid hormones, like most hormones in the body, they're released in that trophic cascade, which means that you have the hypothalamus in the brain and the pituitary, which each release hormones in a feedback loop based on what each of the other organs is emitting. And then that affects the target organ. So in this case, the target organ is thyroid. So hormones may be released or they may not. It depends on the presence of exogenous, otherwise known as external hormones that then affect the rest of the body's physiology. So in this situation, if they're already taking a thyroid hormone, we may not get a good assessment. So some patients go get testing and they've been taking their thyroid hormone that morning. So we don't know, like they took their levothyroxine the morning of their lab testing. I don't necessarily have a good snapshot of what happened for them. Or there's another something that's quite frequently I'm noticing that patients don't always know about. The biotin can look like some of the thyroid hormone components. And so if you dosed some of your supplements, but not all of them, and one of them contained biotin, we may not get an accurate reading of thyroid. So there's all these components to the thyroid. Do you have an ongoing condition that maybe we could have skirted? Do you not have enough iodine in your diet or selenium? Maybe your thyroid organ itself is not processing well. There's lots of pollutants that can easily affect the thyroid and make it like hypofunctioning. And then if you were dosed really young on exogenous thyroid hormone, and then you're taking it with something that inhibits it, that's a whole other story. And then there's that component that I'm involved in quite frequently, which is typically none of the antibodies have been run to assess the thyroid. So I'm talking thyroperoxidase, thyroglobulin binding hormones, none of the really autoimmune antibodies have been assessed, or even their reverse T3, and then also their ability to handle certain foods. So in some people, gliadin from gluten can be perceived by the body as thyroid hormone, and then that affects its function as if they were taking exogenous thyroid hormone. And then, of course, are they dosing their medication with substances that inhibit the hormone's absorption? So there's so many different facets to the development of hypothyroidism and hyperthyroidism. You think that in a developed country, we would have less instances of hypo or hyperthyroidism, but I'm actually finding that these nutrients may not be replenished in the body or processed in the body, or there's a conversion issue. There's just so many things that can go wrong with this little butterfly-shaped organ. You would think because of its shape, it would be friendlier to us, but it's not.
And that's why I think it's so important to find a practitioner like yourself who's really looking for the root cause, because if that patient does just go to their general practitioner, they run a TSH and says your thyroid is fine, they may be missing a really big component or the cause of all of their symptoms.
Right. And then if it is an autoimmune thyroid and then it goes undeveloped, and a few years later, they could develop a worsening of their symptoms that affects all the way down to the joints. So sooner we can curb these kind of things, the better.
Definitely. And I think that's why one of the naturopathic principles, docere, is so important, and just educating your patients so that they can be their best health advocates.
I love that you said that. I encourage all of my patients to be their own health advocate, because I'm not really in the position where I don't really like to be in, you know, that authoritative position of power. I like to be in the let's facilitate your healing and growth, and let me be here to hold space for you so that you can do that. And I'll provide the tools. But ultimately, the person that gets to walk the walk every day is the person in that body, not me.
I couldn't agree more. Now, I do also want to start talking a little bit about different diseases that can present with joint pain. So maybe like rheumatoid arthritis and how it differs from osteoarthritis.
Oh, that's a fabulous question. So we're talking really when we talk to the basis of RA versus OA, we're talking inflammatory versus mechanical. So osteoarthritis is usually mechanical, history of acute or chronic trauma, there's overuse, hypermobility, instability, or there's immobility. And that ultimately the result would be a breakdown of articular hyaline cartilage and then subchondral bone. And really what I'm saying when I say that is that if we got a radiograph, we could see osteophytes, we could be seeing cysts, calcifications, some soft tissue swelling, maybe there's subchondral sclerosis or joint space narrowing. And this is, again, from mostly trauma or overuse. And then in RA, we have an inflammatory component. That's where the joint is warm to the touch, differencing in when the stiffness occurs, the joint stiffness, and the length of time, typically carpal metacarpal involvement and the PIP, or you want to order antibodies because it's an autoimmune inflammatory disease, then maybe we need to order the anti-CCP or rheumatoid factor, get an ESR, get a CRP. So those are inflammatory markers, and just get an assessment of, you know, how advanced is this case? How progressive, how aggressive do we need to bring on a DMARD, a pharmaceutical medication? Do we need biologics? How heavy hitting do we need to be? And of course, that being said, when I see a rheumatological patient, I always love for them to have a conventional rheumatologist. Whether that rheumatologist knows that they're working with me or not is not really important to me, so long as they're being the patient's being honest about their dietary regimen and their supplement regimen with their other provider, because we could have systemic infection or sepsis, or the joint could be septic and in the inflammatory component. But really in RA, the focus here is small joint involvement. And there's synovial fluid buildup, there's synovitis, inflammation of that synovium, the nodules that could develop, there's vasculitis, so inflammation of the vessels, there could be lung fibrosis. But most frequently, it's warm to the touch joints, morning stiffness. And unfortunately, in these situations, the reason why we take it so serious is the leading cause of death is usually cardiac related. So that's a good example of some of the comorbidities we have developing with these autoimmune conditions. But ultimately, when you're trying to decide between mechanical and inflammatory, it's not really up to you as the patient. It's something that your provider should be looking into, because we don't assume that you have the tools and know-how to parse that out. And quite frequently, doctors make the worst patients because they've already gone on this whole spiel of what they think is going on and they can't separate themselves from the outcome.
Now, because RA is an inflammatory condition, obviously the treatments are much different than they are for osteoarthritis. Do you have any favorite modalities that you like when providing patients with supportive treatment for RA?
Oh, I love to do everything by the person. So, of course, RA, inflammatory, want to manage the inflammation. We need to stop the disease progression. How aggressive is it? What can I do to stop it? How heavy hitting do I need to be with the anti-inflammatory? And sometimes patients will come already on, you know, prednisone or methotrexate, and then we need to evaluate for nutrient deficiencies before we even consider weaning off medications. Something that does need to be said, I have this happen quite frequently, is patients, they're a longstanding misunderstood autoimmune patient, and they want to stop their medication. They feel like their provider's not meeting them where they're at. So they stop at cold turkey, and then they have a whole other manifestation of disease involvement that they really weren't prepared to handle. So I always say, if you're considering discontinuing your medication, it's important to work with someone. If you don't feel like your current provider is that person, then seek out someone before you just discontinue them. But if it is aggressive, you know, they may need pharmaceutical intervention. But there's a whole host of nutraceuticals and botanicals that I prefer to use, as well as hydrotherapy, one of my favorite modalities. So there's so much that can be done. And then my ultimate favorite, which I'm sure you're tired of hearing about, but that would be clinical nutrition. I would want to assess their food intolerances. What's an instigatory factor here? And do we need to do an elimination diet and then reintroduce food after we've healed the gut? You know, what's best for this patient?
Well, it's great to hear that there's a lot of different modalities that could potentially help with a lot of these different autoimmune conditions. I'd also like to talk to you about psoriasis. It seems that I have quite a few friends that have psoriasis, and they all seem very confused about it. They'll do things that work for a period of time, then they get flare-ups again. But I know with psoriasis, it could manifest itself in, of course, a rash, as well as joint pain. What have you found usually comes first? Is it the rash as the first sign, or does the joint pain usually present itself first?
Ooh, my experience might not define every other provider's experience, but a lot of times people say, what seems to be the general sentiment that I hear is, oh, someone with the lesions may not develop the arthritis. And that's not been my experience. Quite frequently, they go hand in hand. It just depends on how early was the lesion assessed. And as I was mentioning, you know, people can go undiagnosed with psoriatic lesions for a long time because they don't always present the same way. There's pustular, there's guttate, there's plaque. There's things that come on after strep infection and another interesting infection that I'm more than happy to talk about in a few minutes. So we have to figure out what's going on. And kind of something interesting, little tidbit, is that psoriatic patients may have an increase in their uric acid levels. So when you draw labs and you assess the inflammation with that erythrocyte sedimentation rate and the C-reactive protein, sometimes people will throw in the uric acid if they're trying to differentiate conditions. And some people, what I've had some of my fellow providers have said, oh, maybe they have gout. And it's because of the joint pain, because of the arthritic component. And then you have to say, hey, well, what are the clinical symptoms? Do they have the nail pitting, the oil slicking, the joint pain, the dactylitis, which is like sausage swelling of your toes? And then the psoriatic lesions, are they patchy? Are they plaquey? Do they have a really sustained, well-demarcated border? Is there underlying uveitis, inflammation in the eye? And then on their radiograph, on their x-ray, do they have a pencil in a cup deformity that's classic of psoriasis or psoriatic arthritis? Maybe they're HLA-B27 positive, but that's not to say there are seronegative where they're HLA-B27 negative and they still have psoriasis. So definitely with those friends of yours, Jonathan, what I would say is, did they get down to the root cause of what's going on? Because a lot of time in the psoriasis component, it's gut dysbiosis, long-term gut dysbiosis. And I'm not just talking like, hey, you have some excess of a probiotic, you've been taking too much of one probiotic. It could be fungal infection. There could be not so friendly bacteria, overgrowth of commensal bacteria in there. It's good to get an assessment and figure it out. And then are they reacting to foods? A heck of a lot of my patients with psoriasis cannot tolerate pork. And that doesn't mean, you know, that every psoriasis patient can't tolerate pork, but I just have seen that quite frequently. So of course, in that situation, you want to manage the inflammation, treat and heal the gut, figure out what foods are the trigger, heal the lesions, and then heal the body is my motto. Stress management. Sometimes I talk about psoriasis developing as like little plaque shields of the skin, little shields, because the patients are not processing things and they're trying to protect themselves. And then there's supporting the liver. And then our classic underlying vitamin D deficiency that you would be super surprised how frequently I have on the floor vitamin D levels in the Southwest. It's super surprising. And then, of course, that dyslipidemia that I mentioned earlier can play an issue, play a role in all of that as well.
It's fascinating how many factors could really predispose someone to psoriasis.
It absolutely boggles my mind. Like, we still don't have a firm understanding of what the initiating trigger factor is for some people. Like I mentioned, one woman, her experience with her mother-in-law, and then the development of such a severe, debilitating autoimmune condition. I mean, it's just amazing the body's reactive mechanism and in the form of autoimmunity. Here I am going on about how much I love these things. Oh, goodness.
Now, you mentioned that with a lot of these patients, you see really low vitamin D levels. So would you prefer that they go out into the sunshine and get their vitamin D that way? Or do you prefer supplementation?
Oh, fabulous question. So one of my esteemed mentors, and I often say I did her like residency because I was followed this woman to the, I will follow her to the end of the earth. But she had suggested to one of my patients that they just go to a tanning bed for 15 minutes. And I about dropped my mouth on the floor. I was like, what? Because studies have shown that even 15 minutes, a single session of 15 minutes can predispose you to melanoma. And living in the Southwest here, we don't have a lot of chances. So let's take care. Let's cover up. Let's, you know, monitor the times that we're getting exposed and making sure we're having a decent amount of antioxidants in the nutrients before we go out into the environment. But I would caveat that by saying, so I don't prefer the artificial light, of course, but I also would prefer my patients limit their sun exposure. And it's usually based on their age and then what kind of skin I'm working with. Do they easily freckle? Do freckles turn to moles? If they get how many really bad sunburns have they had in their life? What area of the body is it? I've had gutate psoriasis patients who have mostly core involvement. And if I just say, hey, go for a walk for 10 minutes, they're not going to get the portion of their body exposed that has the lesion to benefit the lesion. So I like to do a little bit of both, and I configure it based on the person. A little bit of outside sun time, strategically timed so it's not necessarily the brightest of the day, depending on the time of year. And then as well as supplementation after we get some rigorous labs. And then it's important that every time you supplement someone, which you already know, Lorena, you've got to make sure that they're dosing it appropriately and with foods that it will be processed properly. So I have a lot of patients who come to me and they're taking 50,000 IUs vitamin D3. And I'm like, wow, that's a lot. You know, how long have you been on that dose? And they've been on it for 10 years and you're like, wow, okay. And then you got to figure out, well, is oral or is it sublingual? Are you dosing it with a fatty food? And then you get their lab back and they've got suboptimal vitamin D levels. And you say, hey, if you're going to, you know, either the quality isn't what you think it is, or the way that you're dosing is not appropriate. So I like to do a little bit of both and make sure that we're tailoring it safely, because sometimes, as fabulous as these patients are, they do go a little wild with the dosing and the supplementation on their own.
And that's what can be a little bit worrisome too, especially now with, there's quite a bit of research on vitamin D and COVID-19. And vitamin D is a fat-soluble vitamin. So it's possible that a lot of people can just be going to the drugstore, picking up vitamin D and dosing really high amounts for long periods of time.
Then we've got to be concerned about parathyroid, mm-hmm, hormones and that whole component with the kidneys and the bones. It's a everything in the body. It's a well-oiled machine, but it's so fragile, which we can especially see in the manifestation of autoimmune conditions. So it's super important that people are checking in with their providers. I can't tell you the number of times someone's come in and they say, oh, should I start taking vitamin D? Because they saw the studies about COVID, which we know there's a huge component of vitamin D supplementation in most infectious disease states and just in supporting the immune system. And then are they getting the right ones? Are they getting the quality ones? Are they dosing it appropriately? Are they dosing too much? Right. There's a maintenance dose versus the therapeutic dose and what's really called for in this state of affairs. So you're absolutely correct. It is a little worrisome.
Definitely. And speaking of supplementation and infectious diseases, I'd love to know your favorite ways to best support the immune system.
Hydrotherapy. The use of water as a form of therapy. It's such an underutilized tool in the naturopathic toolbox. It could be as simple as ending your shower with cold or as complicated as infrared sauna with color light therapy. It's just a subtle way to maintain your immune system, and also quite frequently you're supporting the body and detoxifying itself. So I think that's my number one favorite way. And then probably a close second would be focusing on that mindset. I'm a believer firmly that what you focus on is what you attract. And I've seen it in my life time and time again. By focusing on health and wellness and taking the time to listen to our bodies, we can really facilitate that body's healing capacity much quicker than, as we were talking about before, if you just swept it under the rug and kind of ignored it.
Definitely. I totally agree with you on the importance of mindset. And we're big fans of hydrotherapy. I usually end my showers on cold and, you know, ice baths once in a while. And we love our infrared saunas. And Lorena got me into warming socks. So I think what's nice about hydrotherapy is it's accessible to pretty much everyone. It's cost effective. If you have access to running water, which not everyone does, but if you do, you could do it in your shower, do it in a bath. There's a lot of different modalities that could best fit into your lifestyle.
Oh my goodness, Jonathan, I'm so glad you said the word accessibility. That's so important to me and my patient population, is making sure that the things that I'm recommending, you don't always need me around for. That's really what I'm looking to integrate into people, is a habit, a lifestyle that they don't need to see me every day for the rest of their lives. I'm preparing them with tools and knowledge and training to take care of themselves and advocate for themselves.
100%. And that's what makes you such a great doctor.
Oh, I'm blushing.
Now, I'm curious if there's any new research that you've been really excited about lately.
Oh my goodness. Quick tangent. Yes. The answer is yes. I love infectious disease. I will caveat, you know, I'm morbidly interested in coronavirus. I probably every day I'm reading an article, a different article about it. And it's not necessarily like, oh, I'm obsessing about the mortality or anything of that nature. It's just interesting, as chronic infectious disease is one of the main things that I'm interested in medicine. It's interesting to see, wow, the world is dealing with this, and how are individuals dealing with it, especially our autoimmune patients. So what I've had now is a few people who come to me with guttate psoriasis. And now that's the special type of psoriasis where usually we think it's post-strep. So what happens is they see a dermatologist, they get diagnosed with guttate lesions, and then they get tested for strep. And guess what? Their strep test is negative because it's not initiated by strep. They had asymptomatic symptoms. So maybe they did have symptoms, or they just thought it was a meager cold and didn't think anything of it. And they actually had coronavirus. And what ended up developing in them and manifesting in them was guttate psoriasis. So they develop these plaque skin lesions. They get tested for strep, strep's negative. They get their coronavirus antibodies tested for COVID-19. And they come back that they did have a previous infection, and then they're no longer infectious. And what remains is this lingering guttate psoriasis. Wow. So very interesting. The British Medical Journal has a fascinating article out about it from a couple months ago. And that's what I've been seeing a lot lately. Not a lot, but that's what I'm excited about. And I have a handful of people I've been helping through that.
How fascinating. And I'm sure we'll see that within the coming months too.
Yeah, hopefully it's getting diagnosed properly too, because, you know, these are people who are like one woman came to me, she had gone through the whole gamut and even gotten ultraviolet therapy and skin scrapings of the lesions. And I was like, oh my goodness, I wish I would have seen you like a couple months before. So she's going to have those scars for a while.
Now, I'm curious to know if you have any like success stories or interesting cases that you've seen in practice. I know you've mentioned a lot throughout our interview, but anything that really stands out.
I am constantly in awe of the human body. I guess one of the most fascinating cases thus far, young Hispanic patient. When I say young, when she was first diagnosed, just late teens, early 20s, she developed lupus nephritis. So her kidney involvement was pretty severe, and that's inflammation of the kidney as a result of lupus. It landed her in the hospital a few times, but she didn't know why she was in the hospital. So when I say landed her, she just had some of those nondiscreet lesions, sun sensitivity, cyclical fevers, just couldn't really get a firm understanding of what was going on with her. She didn't feel right. She had malaise. And she went to multiple hospitals, different locations, different providers, was sent home. And finally, when she presented, she was all the way in lupus nephritis. Her kidneys were completely involved. And an incredible naturopath that works largely in rheumatology is the one that intercepted her after her final lupus nephritis visit to the ER. She got C3, C4 complements tested, which are components that we use to measure lupus disease progression, and then inflammatory markers that I was talking about before that we also use to quantify disease involvement in lupus, and then glomerular filtration rate, right, which is that processing the little glomerulus horseshoe shape in the kidney that processes the fluids. And that was of particular concern with her because of her lupus affecting the kidneys so greatly. So I got to be a part of her disease maintenance, and she had a few flares and ebbs and flows while I was a part of her team. But last I know, she's living a happy and healthy life despite the initial presentation of lupus nephritis that could easily have been the end of things as we knew it. So
it's amazing. That's very uplifting, and hopefully it gives people out there hope that regardless of how bleak a diagnosis might look, you have to just have faith and stay positive and surround yourself with the right team of medical professionals and be open to trying different modalities. And hopefully eventually you find something that works.
Exactly. Nail on the head.
For sure. Now, a question that we love to ask on our podcast is that if you could sit down and have tea with anyone dead or alive, who would it be and why?
So are you guys familiar with Carolus Linnaeus?
Yes. Yep.
He was a Swedish botanist, and he's responsible for a lot of the classification system that we know it today of plants with the species and genus. If I could have tea with Carolus Linnaeus, it would be an absolutely amazing experience. I'd want to dissect everything, how he figured out the classification system, why he came to feel that we needed it, and just general ideas and questions about botany, because it's one of my all-time favorite healing modalities, and I love plants.
That's amazing. I love it. Now, where can people find you if they want to work with you or kind of just see what you've been up to? Where are the best places that they can reach you?
My website probably holds it all, drlilyhartwell.com, and it's L-I-L-L-E-A. It's like Chelsea, but with Lily. And then I have a Facebook page. It's Dr. Lily Hartwell. It's a business Facebook page. And then Instagram. Everyone loves the gram. I do, as of this recording, I'm doing weekly Instagram lives, and we have tea and gratitude sessions, and just, it's a beautiful experience to end the week with. And maybe I'll see some of you guys there.
Yes. Yeah. And we'll definitely check it out as well. That sounds amazing.
Awesome.
Well, thank you so much for joining us and for giving us such great insight into a topic that I honestly wanted to learn so much more about, because, you know, it's affecting so many different people, and it's good to know more about its onsets, how it affects people differently, and modalities that you found to be successful with it.
Thank you so much for having me. And I love the idea of the teas that you guys have produced. It's fabulous.
Thank you for joining us on our episode with Dr. Lily Hartwell. We discussed various different autoimmune conditions and their possible etiologies. Dr. Hartwell also discussed some modalities that she's found to be useful in the supportive care of various autoimmune conditions. As always, if you have any questions, you can email us at podcast@drinkdowntoearth.com, or you can get in touch on Instagram at drinkdte. In the meantime, stay healthy and stay hydrated. Cheers.
Now it's time for you to go out there and do at least one small thing to better your health today.
Always choose to make your life a healthier, happier, and a more down-to-earth place.
Until next time,
cheers to good health.